Shemaine Mills reports.
The smartphone app is called Pulse Point. It's free and anonymous. It briefly tracks the location of the phone during an emergency, but does not identify the phone's user. Christopher Carbon is a paramedic and Madison firefighter. He says Pulse Point works like this. When the 911 center gets a call about cardiac arrest in a public place, they alert first responders along with nearby citizens who previously downloaded the app.
And then what happens is it sends out a notification to any of those phones, and it essentially says CPR is needed close to your location. Would you like to respond?
Carbon says last year, Dane County had more than 500 sudden cardiac arrests. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A teenage girl suspected in the deaths of a couple in northern Wisconsin has been arrested in Indiana. Authorities got a 911 call yesterday morning in Oneida County. Deputies say a man and a woman appear to have been murdered. A 17-year-old female suspect was believed to be traveling with a 22-year-old man. Last night, those two were found and arrested in Indiana. Weather today, sunny and very mild, with highs near 50. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Spruce Tree Music and Repair, Pabst Theater, and Sprint Print play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Majestic Live in Madison, presenting William Elliott Whitmore at the Majestic Theater April 17th. The banjoist and gnarled vocalist will share his passion and noted songwriting. Tickets at majesticmadison.com.
We're going to talk about the problems associated with the modern dairy and beef farming industries in America. The problems for our health, for the problems with the health of the environment, and for the well-being of cows. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the co-author of the book Cowed, The Hidden Impact of 93 Million Cows on America's Health, Economy, Politics, Culture, and the Environment. So do you think that cows and our appetites for dairy products and beef contribute to climate change and other issues? Would you be willing to cut back on your consumption of dairy products and beef? We will welcome your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Dennis Hayes is an environmentalist and CEO of the Bullet Foundation, a nonprofit organization devoted to protecting and restoring the environment in the Pacific Northwest. He is the co-author, along with his wife, Gail Boyer Hayes, of Cowed, The Hidden Impact of 93 Million Cows on America's Health, Economy, Politics, Culture, and the Environment. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Joy.
Well, you know, Wisconsin certainly wouldn't be considered America's dairyland without all those black and white Holsteins that call Wisconsin home. And the cheese head would not be our nationally, you know, recognized headgear. Seems that cows have been good for Wisconsin, or have they?
By and large, cows have been good for America. They were brought over not on the Mayflower, but they were brought over on the next ship over, and they've done everything from plowing our fields to pulling our covered wagons to helping Paul Bunyan lumber your part of the world. And we're not anti-cow in any sense, nor are we in any sense anti-cheese. The issue is that cows, which had a symbiotic relationship with humans that stretches back about 10,000 years, have in recent decades been treated much more poorly. And this, they've been doing it in a way that has not been good for the environment, has been really quite bad for cows, and in the end has had some some bad effects upon human health. So our plea is really to turn to the good farmers, including those that are associated with Wisconsin-based Organic Valley, and buy good products from cows that are raised well.
So in essence, you can raise cows in a good way where there is little or minimal damage to the environment and all these other issues, but you are primarily concerned with the larger so-called factory farms?
Yes. The factory farms have been really quite horrible for the cows themselves, and the products that they're producing are having all kinds of terrible consequences. Some of this is, most of this is hidden from the public because the big factories tend to be far away from places where you can smell the odors from their lagoons or where you can smell the odors from the cow manure before it makes it to the lagoons. Our contention has been, having gone across the country looking for ranchers and for dairy farmers who are doing things right, that there is a right way to do it. And I suppose one threshold thing we should say, Joy, though, is that particularly with regard to beef, Americans just eat far more than is good for them. So our proposal is that instead of having diets that are sort of laced with almost 60 pounds a year of pretty high-fat beef, that we reduce that considerably, finish the cows on grass rather than stuffing them with corn to intentionally make them obese and make it a fatter product, and therefore have a healthier lifestyle, and in the process treat the cows a lot better.
Yeah. In the spirit of full disclosure, I will let listeners know that I do not eat beef at all. I'm primarily a vegetarian. But how is that going to make the cow be treated better?
You know, maybe in the spirit of full disclosure, I should say that I hadn't eaten beef for 25 years before we began writing this book. And strangely, having become fond of cows, we now have beef a few times a year, and it is grass-finished and lean and organic. And one reason for that is that we created cows, and if there isn't some purpose for cows, then cows are just basically going to disappear. They can't fend for themselves the way their ancestor, the fierce, fast, cunning, smart, mean Auroch, did. You can't take Elsie out to the gate and slap her on the flank and say, "Okay, babe, you're on your own." And there's no market for lap cows, and there's no market for guard cows. And so if you don't eat them, cows are just going to go away. And so we're trying to reward those ranchers that do it right.
Yeah, so though if we reduce our consumption of, what, bad beef, we're all going to be better off. How so?
Well, it's the enormous amount of land that is now put into growing corn for cows. Some of the very best agricultural land in the world is in corn crops, and for the most part they are being cultivated in ways that produce a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico because of all the nitrogen fertilizers that run off of the field that arguably the most valuable export from Iowa every year is the topsoil that runs down the Mississippi River. It's been having kind of catastrophic impacts on those other parts of the food chain that move into the large factory farms where they're being stuffed with this corn.
Yeah. How else besides, I guess, the runoff, how else is the modern beef industry, I guess, contributing to the problems of climate change or climate problems?
Well, in a fair number of ways. There is some controversy in this because different people draw the lines in different places. But if you put into the calculus the thought that you wouldn't be growing all of this corn if it weren't for a combination of cows and ethanol, I mean, this is number two, dent corn. This is not corn that humans can eat directly. We simply wouldn't be growing it but for cows. And so the nitrogen that goes into it and the manufacture of that fertilizer, the fuel that goes into running all of the equipment, the transportation of it to the factory farms, the maintaining of the factory farms, the refrigeration of the beef, the transport of the beef to the supermarket. You add all of that together, and the contribution to climate change from that is just staggering. Worldwide, it's almost 16% of global warming gases.
Why do you say that the beef that some eat from the cattle raised in these larger operations is not as healthy for us?
Yeah, now this is a place where we've taken a photograph of the current views of medical opinion, and it's always disconcerting when you see new articles coming along every couple of months taking a different point of view. But the large feedlot operations are called fattening operations. The more fat content called marbling that you have in beef, the higher the grade that it is. And that's because fat tastes good to people. It's part of the way that we evolved. You know, before we became a modern industrial society, people, like everything else in nature, was constantly in a search to get just as much energy in as concentrated a form as possible. And it's hard to beat fat for that. And so these factory farms, for the most part, are producing things with a consistent taste and with a high degree of marbling in it. And that tends to also have a whole lot of saturated fat compared to the unsaturated fats. The general consensus is that this is contributing to obesity. It's contributing to vascular and heart problems. There's some fair amount of literature that suggests that it may be having a bad effect upon brain activity. And most everyone, I think there would be like a 99.9% consensus in the medical community, regardless of whether or not you think that some of this is desirable, that there's a consensus that we have far too much of it in our diets.
Yeah. We have just a minute before we have to take a short break, you say that the cows themselves, the cattle on these larger operations, are not happy cows?
No. The cows did not evolve to eat corn, and so unless you add a whole bunch of other things to it, which is rarely done in the large feeding operations, it produces acidosis, a very acidic disorder in their intestines that in some cases eat right through the walls of the intestines, can destroy the liver and open the cows to vulnerability to disease. And disease is pretty prevalent in these large feedlots. So we then stuff them full of antibiotics and help to create antibiotic resistance that comes back and haunts us as humans.
We will talk more about the problems and the solutions, the alternatives to the modern beef industry after we return from this break. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Kerdine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with the co-author of the new book, Cowed: The Hidden Impact of 93 Million Cows on America's Health, Economy, Politics, Culture, and the Environment. Our guest is Dennis Hayes, who is an environmentalist and CEO of the Bullet Foundation, a nonprofit organization devoted to protecting and restoring the environment in the Pacific Northwest. We welcome your questions for him, your reactions to what you're hearing at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So are you willing to cut down on your beef consumption to a half pound per week, for example? Will you start eating less but better beef? And what are your thoughts on how modern or larger cattle operations throughout the country are affecting our environment, our health, and for that matter, the health of the cows? We have full lines, so let's go to Sandy in Algoma first. Hello, Sandy.
Hi, Joey. You know, I'm from Kewaunee County, and we have a huge problem with the dairy industry in Kewaunee County. We have the highest concentration of CAFOs, or concentrated animal feeding operations, in the country there, because of the fact that we have very little land mass compared to the amount of cows that we have. We are the farmers are spreading equal to the amount of human waste that is produced in Milwaukee, Madison, St. Louis, and two Green Bays, and it's being spread on a fairly small county. Plus, our soils are very thin, and we have a lot of karst bedrock there, which allows for quick transport of those nutrients from the top of the ground down into the aquifer. So we have a lot of contaminated wells. My well's contaminated. Many of my neighbors are. We can't drink our water. The USDA came out and did testing last spring, and they basically said that our water was like that of a third world country because it is just that bad.
Oh, Sandy, I'm so sorry. Why is this happening in Kewaunee County, and why has it been allowed to happen?
Well, and that's a good question. DACAP 51, which is the state law, it has stripped all of the control that we should have from our local governments, and it basically says that is the animal facility siting ordinance, and it says that no county, town, village, or municipality shall deny a permit for a CAFO or for an expansion. So they can put them anywhere they want, and we can't stop them. And that's basically what they've done. We're now up to 19 CAFOs in Kewaunee County. That is an increase of 38% compared to most of the other counties in the state, which have dropped in number for the amount of CAFOs and the amount of cows that they have.
What do you think of that, Dennis Hayes?
Well, it's exactly the problem that we're worried about. I mean, this is that transition that I was talking about. Back a few decades ago, those cows would have been mostly pastured and fed hay in the winter. And when they're out in the pasture, of course, the amount of excreta that comes out of the cow is just returning to the soil, the nutrients that are brought out of the soil. When you stick them all on these concentrated operations, then you have this vast amount of waste that builds up, and there's no way economically to take cow poop and move it back to the cornfields of Iowa. And so it does sink down into the water table, and it does provide exactly the kind of contamination that this woman is describing. Interestingly, for the first time in a long time, there's been a break in the agricultural community here in Washington where other kinds of farmers are militating against people who want to move into their counties with confined animal feeding operations simply because of the sort of problems that she's describing.
Yeah, I know that there are some other movements in other parts of Wisconsin where they're trying to crack down on the CAFOs. Let's talk a little bit about you mentioned at the very start you're not against, you know, you're not anti-cow, and the cow has been good for us in many ways. But talk a little bit about, I guess, the history of this. I mentioned in Wisconsin. I know Wisconsin wouldn't be Wisconsin if it weren't for the German immigrants and Swiss immigrants and others who came here and started the small little family farms to feed themselves and maybe help feed the community. And that's why we have roads, and that's why Wisconsin grew, our economy grew, and why we're even a state. Talk about maybe some of the good of cows.
Well, cows have bonded with human beings now for almost 10,000 years. They began with an animal called an aurochs, A-U-R-O-C-H-S, which as a wild game animal was really very fierce. Julius Caesar used to fear for his troops when they encountered a herd of aurochs. They took them and fought them in the Colosseum. From that, some incredibly brave or foolish, almost certainly young man who did not live to reproduce, had the idea of milking one of them that they'd captured probably as a calf. And over time, from a relatively small number of them, we've bred up 800 different breeds of cow, much slower, much dumber, generally bred for particular purposes. So we had powerful oxen that pulled wagon trains across the country. We had and pulled plows around the farms of Wisconsin. We have cows that are designed to survive in the Siberian winter and to prosper in the very hot humidity of India. And we've basically created these creatures ourselves to perform different kinds of work for us. They pulled barges down canals. They provided for marauding armies, interestingly, for a long time in history. You know, armies travel on their stomachs. You have to have something that goes with you as a source of food, and cows, which ate grass and forbs, would travel with these armies as they captured large swaths of territory from the sedentary agricultural interests. They were movable sources of protein.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what happened, though, in modern times? Why is it that we don't have as many of those little tiny, family farms, the Red Barn and the Holsteins, wandering outside of it? And instead we have these big CAFOs in Kewaunee County. What happened? Why has this change happened?
It's a whole bunch of things. At the most obvious but somewhat superficial level, it's the constant drive to have things be less expensive. And if you're trying to generate just as many pounds of beef as possible per dollar that goes into it, then a confined animal feeding operation that has relatively little land, imports relatively cheap grain, and is able to foist its environmental harm off on the public by not having any sewage control at all at these strangely named lagoons, which is where you put the animal waste, then that becomes really cheap sources of beef and particularly cheap sources of hamburger. The other kinds of elements in it, though, are the power of the farm lobby to get agricultural price supports for various things. The power of the Iowa caucuses. I don't know, you may have seen last week that the Republican presidential candidates went to meet with a variety of billionaires to make sure that their views were simpatico. One of them is one of the major corn producers in Iowa, who assembled a bunch of his colleagues and put all of these people through their paces to make sure that nothing would happen to the very generous subsidies that are given to corn production. And then there's the consolidation of the meatpacking industry, which operates much more efficiently if it has these huge factories that have a constant volume of cow coming in from large centralized facilities, and on and on. The system just sort of developed in a way that became this inexorable force. One thing that many people don't know, I didn't know before we started looking into the book, is where the assembly line came from. This is from the Swift Meatpacking Company that was using a disassembling process, mechanizing the ways that cows were taken apart, put into meat. It was visited by Henry Ford, who had the insight that, well, if you can take things apart in this super efficient way, maybe we could put things together in a super efficient way. And out of that came the automobile assembly line.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dennis Hayes, who is co-author of Cowed, The Hidden Impact of 93 Million Cows on America's Health, Economy, Politics, Culture, and the Environment. Our next caller is Gretchen in Belmont. Hello, Gretchen.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
I would just like, I'm listening here. I want everyone to know that I'm a farmer and I eat meat every day. And you made a few references to cows, which actually I think you meant like feedlot steers and heifers being fed antibiotics daily in a feedlot situation. So my first question is, which antibiotics do you believe they're being fed? And my second question is, what farms have you been on during the hottest days or coldest days of the year to compare those living conditions of those feedlot cattle that are living in confinement operations versus those cows that are out on pasture?
Well, there's a fairly full spectrum of antibiotics that are being fed to cows, some of them antibiotics that are not applied to human beings, but a huge fraction of them being antibiotics that are applied to humans. It's about 80% of all of the antibiotics that are used in the United States are going into livestock. We have not been in Minnesota farms in the middle of winter, but whether the cows are pastured or in a feedlot, they need to be protected from those cold elements. I didn't mean that you put cows out on pasture when it's 20 degrees below zero.
Well, Gretchen, I know wanted to make the point that antibiotics are used sparingly and only when necessary, and doesn't think that this is something you should be zeroing in on. So what about the contention that antibiotics are only used sparingly?
Oh, if she said that, I'm sorry that I missed it. No, that's just dead wrong. Antibiotics are used not only prophylactically to avoid diseases that are not there, but they're also used as part of the fattening operations. There's controversial literature, but there's some decent amount that suggests that the same thing happens with people. If you have antibiotics as because you're prone to particular infections and you get a pretty steady diet of it, people get fatter as a consequence of that as well. But right now, there are rules that say that you should not be using antibiotics purely to fatten beef, and so instead they say, well, we're not doing it. We're using it prophylactically to avoid disease. But they're exactly the same antibiotics coming in exactly the same quantity, and it's pretty difficult to figure out what motivation lies at the heart. But absolutely wrong to say that they're being used sparingly.
I think my question then is, what antibiotic do you believe is being fed in a fattening operation? I fatten cattle. I feed a lot of cattle every year. And I do not give them, I'm looking at my veterinary bill right now, so for like one bottle of medicine, it was $965. So I can't afford to feed them antibiotics through the fattening process. So if you're referring to an ionophore, which is like a feed additive to help feed efficiency, an ionophore is not a drug that's used in the human food supply, like in human drugs. You can't be prescribed an ionophore. So what antibiotic are you referring to that's being used so irresponsibly, I'll call it?
Yeah, you've nailed me. This is a part of the book that my wife was researching, but these are, again, a broad spectrum of antibiotics that are used in humans, and it would not be part of your pharmacy bill because, ironically, to use them in cows, you do not require a prescription for them, whereas you would with human beings. But I'm embarrassed. I cannot come up with the names.
Thank you very much, Gretchen. We need to move on to some other callers. Lynn in Washera County is with us now. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. We're losing our lake. And E. coli is starting to show up in our water. We've lost three lakes in our county. We've got babies being born that they call them blue babies, but I guess it's the nitrates that are in the water. Our air on days when it blows our way, we have to stay inside with the air conditioning on. We can't go outside. It's really horrible. The manure runoff they put on fields in the winter when it's icy all run off, and they're polluting our trout streams. We're in the sand counties, and Friends of Central Sand have spent $450,000 trying to fight legislature and trying to fight the CAFOs to stop this in our county, and everybody just seems to turn and look the other way. But, you know, very much the same thing that's going on in Kewaunee County, we're trying to prevent in Washera County and Adams County. The other big thing is these manure-laden trucks going over our roads, which we have to pay for as taxpayers, are just damaging our roads. And they run 24 hours a day. They're heavily laden. And, of course, manure is falling off of these trucks as well. It's an awful situation. And if you go out and look at the CAFOs, I've got one less than 2 miles from my home, those cows are out there standing knee-deep in mucky, icky, muddy crud, and there isn't a blade of grass anywhere around them. And they want to put one even closer to the lake. And they swear that just because it's sand, it's not going to get into the aquifer and it's not going to pollute our water. And it already is.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Lynn, for your call. Dennis, a reaction?
Well, it is really quite appalling. I mean, I do not want to romanticize the relationship between cows and people back 50 years ago, but it certainly was very different from having them knee-deep in muck and crowded shoulder to shoulder with one another. When I grew up, I was actually born in Wisconsin, and your former senator, Gaylord Nelson, the father of Earth Day, was one of the most influential people in my life. Back in those days, we cows had names, not barcodes, and we treated them with, you know, they were never treated quite the way that, say, dogs or cats or horses are, but they were treated as sentient beings that had some feelings and the capacity to suffer and to feel pain, and that's just completely disappeared, as they are now widgets in an industrial machine that produces the kinds of conditions that your callers are describing.
Susan on Facebook says, I have mixed feelings as I love beef and dairy products, but how much food could be produced directly for human consumption instead of growing corn and other crops to feed livestock? We have made great strides in recovering energy and fertilizer from livestock waste, but we use large amounts of fossil fuels and acreage to feed them. Do you follow that, Dennis?
Sure. Indeed. And in fact, we would be able to become the major agricultural exporter of the world if in fact, we were to be moving to much less consumption of beef. The topsoil, the kinds of nutrients that are put on them, the kinds of water that are used are just really quite extraordinary for this one pretty small fraction of America's diet. So I agree entirely with your caller. Interestingly, when you've got decentralized dairy operations of the kind that used to characterize Wisconsin and still do characterize many of the smaller organic operations in Wisconsin, then you can capture that manure, put it through, say, a biodigester, produce methane, feed it either into a natural gas pipeline after you scrub it, or just use it directly to burn it in a combustion machine to generate electricity. What's left afterward is compost that is very, very good, that can be reapplied to the soil right there on the spot in the kinds of limited amounts, since it's all stuff that you've taken out of the soil to feed the cows in the first place in a way that maintains the operation decades, centuries, even for millennia. It's the concept of all of the basic nutrients that you want in the soil don't go into making energy. That's hydrogen-carbon bonds, and the rest of it can go back and be very healthy.
So, you know, before we take our next break, I want to talk a little bit about the alternatives. So now we've heard from a couple of callers in different parts of the state about how big and bad the CAFOs are. What is Organic Valley doing differently that you say that, you know, is the alternative?
Yeah, it's really quite this remarkable large cooperative that's headquartered in tiny little Lafarge, Wisconsin, that when we went out to view dairy farmers that were doing things right, I'd say that more than 9 out of 10 of them had an association with Organic Valley, which we had merely seen before we got started in this book after my wife fell in love with cows, as one of competing brands in supermarkets. But I think they really are the platinum standard for organic products. They tend to be quite small compared to the CAFOs, but even compared to some of the other organic operations. They don't use antibiotics in any prophylactic or other way. They recycle their nutrients. They treat their cattle, their cows, their steers, in the case of dairy operations, their cows. It's just across the board, they tended to be people who are genuinely devoted to this and almost as a calling, and cared for their animals well.
And can all dairy and beef operations be like this?
They certainly can if we reduce our demand for it. I mean, there's just an enormous amount of potential pasture land that can be used for these sorts of operations, but not if we're going to be trying to keep the same levels that we do today. Dairy is less of a problem, other than an economic problem that drives it toward CAFOs, because there's far fewer dairy cows than there are steers that are being raised for beef production. But yes, we can certainly have far more than the American diet needs entirely without moving to CAFOs.
We're talking with Dennis Hayes. He is the co-author, with his wife, of Cowed, The Hidden Impact of 93 Million Cows on America's Health, Economy, Politics, Culture, and the Environment. So do you have a question about cows or cattle? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What do you think of this call to eat less beef? Let us know what you think. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Dennis Hayes. We are talking about the beef industry and the dairy industry. Wondering if beef is on your dinner menu today. Our guest wants us to consider the health risks, the climate problems, the animal cruelty that he sees on modern beef and dairy operations. He traces the influence, good and bad, that cows have had on humans throughout history and argues that we should be consuming much less but higher quality beef. And we wonder if you agree or not, or what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Marion in Sullivan is with us next. Good morning.
Good morning. I was raised on a farm. I'm also a retired teacher, so I care a lot about the helpless. And I'd like your opinion on the milk-fed veal industry. What can I do, and other people who care about these poor calves, to convince people not to consume milk-fed veal and farmers not to raise them? Thank you.
What about veal or milk-fed veal, Dennis?
Well, I couldn't agree more. When you have dairy cows, in order to keep them fresh so that they're producing milk, you need to have them having babies. And if they have boy babies, then these are not things that you can raise to produce milk, and so they go into a veal operation most commonly. And that's basically taking very, very young cows, isolating them, giving them a miserable, incredibly brief life, and then slaughtering them. You know, the whole theory behind this book is that political action in this realm has proven to be almost impossible. The farm bill is something that is essentially uninfluenced by anything outside the agricultural interests. The Food and Drug Administration on these things seems to be entirely captured. The Department of Agriculture is always run by people who come from that same mindset, at least ever since the Nixon administration. So what we're trying to do with veal, for sure, and basically, though, with the whole panoply of issues, is to get people to function powerfully as consumers. And your earlier comment, Joy, about being a vegetarian is one that we really admire. And as I said, we spent a big chunk of our lives as vegetarians as well. But vegetarians, true vegetarians, are currently something on the order of 3% of the American population. So it's just not something that's going to be moving and changing things. For people who have chosen to eat beef, then if we can get them, every time they go to a restaurant or go to a butcher shop or are some way involved in a market transaction, to say, I'm appalled that you've got that milk-fed veal here at all, but two, is this beef something that is organic? Is it not just grass-fed at some point in its lifestyle and then grain-finished, but is it grass-finished? And if you ask for that and if they can't give it to you, then you pass. Then you're beginning to create the demand that people will begin to respond from on the production side. And so the theory here is that, as has happened in so many fields, when people begin to demand something, and this is already happening, we're catching a wave, we're not creating a wave. Beef consumption has been going down in this country now for a few decades. Organic products are becoming increasingly common. And it's not just the specialized stores anymore. The overall supermarkets are doing things that would have been considered, you know, almost hippie and flaky back when I was a kid, and are now mainstream. And what we now want to do is make them absolutely dominant.
Thanks to Marion. Let's go to Mark now in Cottage Grove. Hi, Mark.
Hi. When I was growing up, my grandparents had a farm, a small dairy farm. And now the farm's been sold, the dairy cows are gone, and it's a grain-only operation. I'm sure the cows have been replaced twofold in a factory somewhere. But growing up in that atmosphere, I would always hear about a national law that set, it, rumors, I don't know if it exists, it set the price of milk from your distance from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I think. And I was wondering, does that law exist? And what effect does that have on small family farms? I don't even know if it's a real law.
Well, the
comments.
Do you know much about that? The price of milk formula based on Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Dennis?
That's very strange. It may well exist, but I've never heard anything about something based on the distance that you are from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. It might be some kind of a state law or a state regulation. There are lots of things that the government and the dairy industry cooperate on, including advertising campaigns and what have you. And there are substantial milk subsidies, so that if you've got a year where milk is dramatically overproduced, it's acquired by the federal government to maintain the price of milk and then converted into dried milk, powdered milk, and stored in gigantic facilities outside St. Louis. But I know nothing about something that's based upon Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
It is actually it's quite bizarre. We'll see if we can look it up before the end of the show. There is something that the milk prices were based on distance from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, way back when, and I'm not sure if it still exists on the books. But I mean, it is America's Dairyland after all. But,
yep.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. We'll check into that. So I mean. What other laws govern our dairy and beef industries?
What's kind of remarkable is what laws don't. A woman earlier was talking about the amount of waste going into her county being equal to the human sewage that's coming out of, I think she said, Milwaukee plus Wisconsin and four Green Bays. that cow waste is merely stored in lagoons. It's not treated. Whereas the human waste in all of those cities is governed by the Clean Water Act of 1972 and some subsequent amendments. So we put an enormous amount of effort into cleaning up human waste and virtually none into cleaning up cow waste, although it's a greater volume than there is of human waste. It's I think, the largest, by volume for sure, the largest single source of utterly unregulated pollution.
Yeah. So, but we had Christy Taylor, my producer, did look it up, and I don't have all the information, but the minimum price for milk in most parts of the United States still depends on how far you live or are from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So I'm not sure why, but I remember us talking about that on a program in the past, and it's somehow in the Farm Bill. So
fabulous. I did not know that.
Q in Madison is with us. Hello, Q.
I'm a vegetarian, mm-hmm. and the reason I'm a vegetarian is I want to live as low on the food chain as possible. I'm not a vegan vegetarian, although I would like to be, but I don't have that option here in assisted living. But the pollution that goes into plants is all concentrated in dairy and more concentrated in beef, which I don't eat.
There's less, a vegetarian is polluting less by eating plants than eating beef, Dennis?
Well, food chains are of course, as I expect any NPR listener knows, something where something small eats something that's a vegetable and then is eaten by something that's bigger and eaten by something bigger. So by the time, for example, in an ocean food chain, you get to a tuna, you're eating an enormous amount of stuff that's all concentrated in the final thing. With regard to cows, it's slightly different, particularly if you're having cows of the sort that we're talking about in our operations. They would be eating grasses and forbs, which humans are unable to digest. And they're not eating little animals or other things that are bouncing up through the food chain. So if you want to get food value out of grasses, and big parts of the land actually are probably at their highest and best use, certainly their most sustainable use if they are kept as grasslands, then there's no way to get that value into human beings except by eating something that grazes. I think it's an entirely valid moral position to say, well, even so, these are living animals with feelings and we shouldn't eat them at all. But I don't think it's so much a food chain issue.
So, Dennis, tell us again why you and your wife, who were longtime vegetarians, have recently started eating beef intentionally, but only grass-fed beef.
Well, it's really peculiar, and it's mostly out of a love of cows, in a sense that unless there is a market for cows, and unless they are providing something that is good, then humans will not spend the time and energy to raise them and to care for them. We were on a trip to the United Kingdom, and Gail started seeing all of these herds of unusual-looking, some of them really quite charming-looking, the Scottish Highlanders, for example, really captured her fancy, that she just had never seen in the United States. She'd never been up close to a cow in her entire life. And as some Audubon Society members keep life lists of birds, she started keeping a list of the different kinds of cows that she saw and took photographs of them and came back and started looking them up to try to find out what all of these things were. And out of that, you know, I'd come home at night after work and she'd, with the benefit of the internet, hit me with four or five new facts about cows, and eventually we became sufficiently enchanted with the whole idea that we decided that probably other people were operating from the same way that we were, and we'd learn as much as we could and convey it. Out of that, it came the conviction that unless somebody was supporting these dairy farmers and ranchers who were trying to do it right, but producing products that, without internalizing all of those environmental costs, were more expensive than the conventional feedlot operations were. If we were not their market, then who in the world was going to buy it? And if no one bought it, then these people who were trying to do it right would not be able to make a living. So out of all of that, I realize that's a convoluted set of turns there, we decided that we would begin occasionally to have meat. And it's, in my case, it's almost exclusively in restaurants, and it's as a result of being kind of an obnoxious, well, I'm sweet about it, but I will really lay it into a waiter, even as I do with seafood, to make sure that it's sustainable seafood, that make sure that the beef is coming from an operation that I really want to support.
Yeah. So very briefly, some advice for the rest of us who might want to, either in a restaurant or in a store, there's a lot of labels, natural, free range, organic. How do we sort through this to decide what we want?
Organic and grass-finished are both good. And interestingly, if it says USDA grass-fed, that actually means grass-finished. If it just says grass-fed, it literally means nothing. All beef is grass-fed at some point in its life. To be self-serving, I'd say buy and read the book or go to your library and get the book, because it gives you some sort of detailed instructions on how to run through this and what you should be looking for to get products that are good for cows, good for the environment, and really good for you.
Dana in Two Rivers is with us. Hello, Dana.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. One of the topics that I didn't hear too much about is how people that wish to eat meat can actually just go. We live in beautiful Wisconsin, so people can go and actually find a farmer. And if they know their farmer, they can meet the animals before they eat them. And I think people have too much of a disconnection between the food they eat, and so they don't care about it. And I think that's a very important point. And we live in Wisconsin, so why not just do it?
Yeah, we didn't talk about community-supported agriculture, which there is a growing movement along those lines, Dennis.
Absolutely. And getting CSAs, getting various kinds of community, community-based markets where farmers mm-hmm. come in with their products are also good steps. But the caller's idea of actually going out, mm-hmm. meeting with farmers, seeing their operations, you know, of all of the farmers that we approached, not one ever said, no, I'm just too busy, don't come out here. The farmers that are doing it right are really quite proud of their operations. And it's an enormous education. You go out and you walk with them, and boy, it's like discussing quantum physics with somebody who has a PhD in it. They will identify everything that is on their farm, every shrub, every every blade of any kind of a grass. It really is quite remarkable, and you can figure out who you feel good about, who genuinely is taking good care of their cows and producing things well. We were at one dairy farmer down in Oregon where there were something like 20 different kinds of birdhouses, because different birds with different kinds of preferences came through at different seasons. And he said, you know, it's just a whole lot better than using tons of insecticides. They really keep the flies down.
Well, we have just a minute to go. Are you hopeful we'll see a change in I guess, cow and cattle operations?
Oh, we absolutely have to, because the current system is completely unsustainable. And it's already happening, as I said. America has passed, you know, we've heard about peak oil and peak this and peak that. We're well past peak cow, and the populations are declining already. Our hope is that this can be accelerated in a fashion, because it's a desirable trend in literally every regard, except those who own the four or five major meat packers and those who own CAFOs.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Joy, it was a pleasure.
Dennis Hayes, he is a co-author with his wife, Gail Boyer Hayes, of COWD, The Hidden Impact of 93 Million Cows on America's Health, Economy, Politics, Culture, and the Environment. Thanks to Christy Taylor, to Kayla Blado, and to Bill Martins for producing and directing these programs. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, answers to your personal finance questions with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Every Tuesday from 8 until 9, it's On Your Money coming up tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.